Thank you very much. The title of my paper, as you can see here, is A Wholesome Article of Food, Rhetoric of Health and Nation in Canada's Margarine Debates from 1917 to 1924. In 1886, the federal government outlawed the manufacture, import, and sale of margarine in Canada. The product remained illegal until 1948, with the exception of a brief reprieve between 1917 and 1924, when it was temporarily allowed. To find the buttons, there we go. This seven-year period saw an intense propaganda war, as butter and margarine supporters attempted to control perception of both products and influence an uncertain legislative situation. My paper today surveys the rhetoric of this debate, noting how health emerged as a key battle cry. Both sides recast their financial and political interests into this seemingly inviolable value. But health itself is a slippery concept, a negotiated ideal. As evolving models of food production and human nutrition intersected with economic instability and social disruptions, the notion of health extended from the individual to the collective body. Concern for Canadians' welfare spoke to issues as varied as race and civilization, nutrition and war, politics and pastoralism. As an everyday substance, food is easily freighted with such larger social trends and tensions, and margarine embodied and inspired vastly different models of what I like to call alimentary citizenship or alimentary nationalism, the idea that an individual can contribute or be made to contribute to the nation through responsible, in this case healthful, food choices. Margarine, or oleomargarine, was invented in France in 1862 as a butter substitute for Napoleon III's military. Or did I say 1862? Sorry, 1869. By the early 20th century, it was generally made with a base of purified beef fat, often with lard or vegetable oils added. Milk or butter, as well as salt, contributed flavor. Such was the substance legalized by an order in council on October 23, 1917, under the auspices of the War Measures Act. The aim was to offset prohibitively high butter prices, but what began as a war measure was revisited in Parliament every year from 1919 to 1923, giving margarine a one-year stay of execution each time. What could have remained a relatively parochial economic concern, whether protecting the dairy industry or keeping prices down during the war, was expressed in much graver questions about the product's transparency, its safety, and nutrition. These bled into more expansive arguments about national welfare and the future of the country. Passionate and often inflated debate ranged from the House of Commons to the nation's kitchens, and many repeated the adage that the strength of a nation depends on the health and strength of its individual members. Antiolio, the National Dairy Council's mouthpiece, summarized their camp's principal irritation. Oleo has no merits of its own. It is a parasite living on the reputation of butter. Although in 1920 new regulations prohibited the use of the words butter, creamery, or dairy on margarine's advertising or packaging, companies could be more subtle, using buttercups on the label, for example, as you can see kind of blurrily in the example on the right. Retailers, boarding house operators, or lumber camp managers might similarly mix the two substances, or simply pass off margarine as butter on the unsuspecting poor. This adulteration by substitution, as it was called, was especially troubling because it replaced a supposedly healthful dairy staple, what one circular called a concentrated food extract from milk, with an apparently lesser substitute made from filthy and inferior oils, the byproduct of the slaughterhouse, little better than axle grease or soap. As one politician put it, the whole thing is a great big greasy fraud perpetrated on the people of Canada. Butter was a transparent item that supposedly originated on the nation's farms. Margarine was opaque, manufactured by corporate interests. One politician deprecated it as a product of doubtful origin, for which we have no complete analysis. This notion of purity, of known origin, ensured that dairy was deeply entwined with issues of race, and this certainly surprised me. As Melanie Dupree explains, quote, "The perfect whiteness of milk and the white body genetically capable of digesting it became linked. By declaring milk perfect, white Northern Europeans announced their own perfection." A government brochure, Canadians Need Milk, noted that the people who have made liberal use of milk as a food have attained greater size, greater longevity, and have achieved much greater advancement in literature, science, and art. Dairy supporters also quoted Herbert Hoover, who said in the European famine after the war, the white race cannot survive without dairy products. Margarine would compromise civility and superiority. Indeed, one MP mockingly likened the regulations controlling the mixing of butter and margarine to eugenics. I've removed defensive vocabulary, but Alan Neal from the riding of Comox, Alberni, argued in all seriousness in the House of Commons, we do not think it is fair to compel the Canadian cow, I had almost said the Christian Canadian cow, to compete against a heathen N-word in the Central American republics or southern states. Such comments were ostensibly grounded in concerns about imported materials used in margarine manufacture, especially cottonseed and palm oils produced in the United States and further afield. But they also, of course, illustrate profound racism. Robin Winks describes the first two decades of the 20th century as the nadir for blacks in Canada. As the study of race was scientifically organized, the stereotypes became more widely known, and as nationalistic rhetoric came to the fore. Neal's vitriolic diatribe went on to express a common argument about unsanitary handling practices through a graphic depiction of black American workers treading out the vegetable oils in their bare feet and spitting tobacco juice into the vats. Margarine was a dark intruder from a sickened economy in the South, and by casting their arguments in the provocative terms of race, Neal and other like-minded defenders of dairy affirmed their goal of protectionism and the notion of building a decent white society through food policy. If you are what you eat, food of uncivilized, unhealthful origin quickly made for an uncivilized and unhealthful nation. Though not always described in such racist terms, margarine's oils could certainly be made to seem threateningly and uncontrollably foreign. The head of the National Dairy Council, for example, similarly described coconut dryers in the Philippines as plagued with skin ulcers, syphilis, intestinal parasites, and tuberculosis. Flies, maggots, and other bugs infested the drying sheds, and the oil was transported to the States to be made into margarine to be sent to Canada in the same tankers used for carrying kerosene. Its contamination and rancidity were disguised through deodorization. The product had duped Canadian consumers. And Neal, among others, saw a parallel with Asian immigration as well. The infiltration of margarine, insidiously replacing wholesome dairy, was akin to the infiltration of inferior races, to use his terms. Talking about restaurants, he fulminated, I thought it would be a change to eat something that no Chinese man had cooked. But when the girl who took the order passed through the swinging door on her way to the kitchen, I saw my old friend, Wang Feng Chu, the same fellow I've seen at every restaurant between here and the Pacific. It is about as easy to stop the fraudulent sale of margarine as butter as it is to prevent the importation of Asiatics under a gentleman's agreement. The parallel is exact, and we in British Columbia know how easy the latter problem is. The National Dairy Council similarly agreed that while Canada was trying to ensure it remained, quote, a white man's country, preventing competition from foreign workers, it had not, unfortunately, taken the same stand in confirming itself as a dairyman's country, signifying a racially pure and culturally civilized way of life protected from foreign competitors. Both the physical and symbolic health of the nation state were at stake. But margarine manufacturers, too, did appeal to ideals of civilization, just in a different form, progress. One issue of oleomargarine asked, ought we now to ban electric light also, because our grandparents did not know it? Margarine was the modern version of butter, with the same wholesome goodness, as well as the advantages of a productive and industrialized society. Harris Abattoir's How It's Made advertisement called the factory a modern churnery. Emphasizing hygiene, this is the ad here, it was a direct counter to the kinds of reports quoted earlier. It strategically began by describing the milk, which was pasteurized on arrival. This was a slight to the dairymen, whom they regularly accused of spreading bovine tuberculosis through contaminated products. The milk was mixed with fats, released into refrigerated water, and left to ripen. The product was then churned with the finest creamery butter and dairy salt. Never touched by human hands, it was made under the eyes of Canadian government inspectors, a triumph of technology and salubrity. The Canadian Medical Association did agree that margarine was a, quote, wholesome article of food. But in the 1910s and 20s, ideas of what constituted good nutrition were shifting rapidly. Anti-margarine representatives drew heavily on emerging work from researchers like Evie McCollum, who had located vitamin A in milk fat and demonstrated its necessity for growth and eye health in rats. One dairyman even proposed that the National Dairy Council should employ a nutrition chemist who could devote his whole time to the study of this oleomargarine question. They extrapolated aggressively, almost to the point of a public health scare, insisting, for example, that xerophthalmia, I hope I pronounced that right, an eye disorder that's caused by a shortage of vitamin A, could reach epidemic proportions if margarine replaced butter. Several anti-oleo brochures also cited an incident at a Jewish orphanage in Rochester when the management decided to try margarine. The children lost weight, which they only gained back after butter was restored. Dairy supporters used this to indict margarine with destroying children's health. Butter, by contrast, was so essential to be, as they put it, a cheap food at any price. Indeed, one politician declared confidently, if erroneously, in the House of Commons, that a vitamin is something vital to the growth of young children and is found only in dairy products. Margarine interests, of course, countered by insisting that their product provided not only an inexpensive supply of calories, but also disputing that butter was the only source of vitamin A in Canadians' diets. They also pointed out butter's deficiency in other vitamins, but clearly healthfulness at this point is still very much under negotiation. But after a war that had killed more than 60,000 Canadians, what did not need to be negotiated was the measure of this nutritional success, the country's physical strength and self-assertion. MP John Sinclair insisted, you cannot maintain an A1 empire on a C3 population. If the use of oleomargarine among the young of the country is going to produce a poorer race of men and women, it's important that the government should prohibit its consumption. Both sides turned to soldiers, unsurprisingly, for their most compelling examples of this good alimentary citizenship. MP Donald Sutherland, who wanted to ban margarine, opined that the Canadian boys who had made a worldwide reputation for themselves during the war did not grow up on oleomargarine. They were nurtured on and nourished by pure, unadulterated butter. The war was apparently a contest of nutrition. Another pointed out that the oleomargarine-consuming nations of Europe had neither the backbone nor the courage to take up the cause, quote, championed by our Canadian soldiers, the cause of Little Belgium. Butter apparently had made Canadians both physically sound and morally righteous. At the same time, though, margarine proponents observed that Canadian soldiers had actually eaten oleo throughout the war, with no deleterious effects. One remarked that certainly they did not lack pep when they met the Germans. Elizabeth Short, seen here, was especially infuriated when dairymen claimed to have willingly sacrificed their own interests by allowing margarine in Canada in order that the troops might be given essential butter. She retorted, "Our men were given oleomargarine, and they demand its continuation in Canada." That's actually true. What is good enough for our men at the front is good enough for us. Trained as an MD, and quite bumptious, I have to say, Short was the leading woman in the Dominion, according to Every Woman's World, this article here, and a key figure in the National Council of Women. She was especially vocal about issues of food cost, nutrition, and child welfare, the typical purview of women's groups. As household managers, women were key in carrying out alimentary citizenship. They were responsible for the health of the national body through the health of the individual body, particularly the body of the child. Though they generally continued to tout milk's importance, many such groups concurred with Every Woman's World that margarine was our new food ally, providing cheap nutrition. And women were increasingly confident that their opinions mattered. Short's organization even took out an ad telling politicians that they would lose women's votes if they did not legalize margarine. At least one MP concluded that since women had been thought deserving of a voice in public affairs, it only made sense that the government should depend on them as advisors in such matters. Women were the sentinels of healthful household economy. Food restrictions also raised questions about the state's right to define and enforce good citizenship through what it determined to be and presented as good food. Many observed that Canada was the only civilized country to ban margarine. If it were truly pernicious, this would not be the case. One issue of Oleomargarine listed 21 countries, quote, a regiment of the elite of civilization that march in step on the vital matter of unfettered choice in the use of all wholesome foods. By the side, out of step, looking somewhat ridiculous to others, but not knowing it, is the one exception, Canada. Michael Clark from Red Deer observed that food prohibitions unwarrantably interfere with the liberty of the subject. Instead, he thought Canadian dairy producers should not fear competition, and butter and margarine should be sold side by side and evaluated by intelligent consumers on their own merits. But there were precedents to the contrary. The state enforced school attendance in the interests of creating good citizens, as one MP pointed out. Was it any more unreasonable to ensure that children were given, quote, nourishing food in order that their physical development may be of the right character? Politicians drew parallels with temperance, too, controlling potentially harmful products for the good of the country, though margarine, of course, did not make people drunk. These examples demonstrate the overlap between the physical and symbolic conditions of the nation-state. The questions of health that arose in the oleomargarine debates were really questions about the future of Canada. And both sides were particularly concerned with soldier resettlement as well. While margarine supporters insisted that low-cost spreads would help ex-soldiers, now struggling as laborers making very little money, dairymen envisioned that their own industry might actually absorb these people. Farmers and governments had invested heavily in dairying, particularly in Western Canada, and any upset or disenchantment through legalized margarine, they argued, could have national consequences. Sutherland observed that land in Western Canada, for instance, was producing 6 bushels an acre less than a few years earlier. The livestock industry was essential in providing fertilizer, lowering the price of breadstuffs, and adding to the country's general prosperity. The National Dairy Council pronounced, "A loyal citizen of Canada should take a pride in the prosperity of his country. Agriculture is our greatest industry, and dairying is the most important branch of our agriculture. It is the patriotic duty of every Canadian to refrain from any act which will be injurious to the dairy interests of Canada." He's referring, of course, to margarine. Dairy farming also civilized the country. "Take away the dairy cow and Canada will become a wilderness," continued the council. And unlike weak civil servants or spoiled city laborers, honest, hard-working dairymen and their families would populate and develop Canada's unoccupied land, and they would make it a healthy nation. As Neil explained, "Go into the country districts and look at the type of young women there. They're strong, vigorous, deep-chested women with a complexion that they did not get out of drugstores. Then go into any town or city from Vancouver to Ottawa, and what do you find? They are small, stunted, anemic-looking. They certainly do not get the dairy products that the growing people in the country get." Savage wilderness and insipid urbanity alike needed to be replaced with hardy pastoral productivity. Farming was emblematic of the country, and failure to support it was a crime against the nation's health and its conscience. But oleomargarine supporters recognized that this sacred ideal, this myth of milk as a lifestyle in itself, was a fantasy. They reported, for instance, on internal debate within the dairy industry about renovated butter, the practice of taking rancid or poor quality cream or butter, treating it with heat and mixing it with a few good ingredients, then repackaging it. Dairy could even be less wholesome than margarine. And its moral probity as the work of small, earnest farmers was not guaranteed. Clark told of a political rival whose substantial investment in a dairy company had guided his anti-margarine position. By contrast, a $300,000 margarine factory in Winnipeg, which would improve local and national economies, could not be built unless the product's legalization was made permanent. With the number of Canadians involved in farming on the decline, perhaps priorities needed to be reoriented, and the country had to decide what form alimentary citizenship should take. The Saskatoon Trades and Labor Council, for its part, believed that, quote, the best citizenship can only be developed on a food standard that permits the purchase of the best class of dairy food products. And the House of Commons eventually agreed. The ban was renewed in 1924. Margarine, cast in the emotional terms of health and vitality, had been a symbol for different visions for the nation. It was the arena in which larger issues of collective welfare and the country's future were contested. To control food and associated concepts of health, as government, industry, and individuals attempted to do, is to control the fate of the nation. Thank you.